Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Patrick from the Poison Pen, and we're here with another one of our virtual events. And today, this is another miracle of technology because I'm here at the bookstore in Scottsdale. Barbara is kind of at a restaurant in New Mexico called, was it Pasquale's, Barbara?
Pasquale's on the plaza in Santa Fe, which I did for David because David lived in New Mexico for quite a while.
And then David Wagner is in Colorado, Pueblo. And Jeffrey Seiger is at an undisclosed location in the northeastern seaboard somewhere.
Northwest New Jersey.
Okay. And we're here to talk mainly about the reissues, very handsome reissues of the first books in their series. And here is Murder in Mykonos, Jeffrey's first book. And here's David's first, Cold Tuscan Stone. And as always, I'm going to be monitoring the Facebook feed. So if you have questions for either of our authors today, please send them in and I will pop up about a half hour in and ask some of the questions. And now I will turn it over to Barbara Peters.
Thank you very much, Patrick. So I would like to think that I were actually in Pasquale's restaurant getting ready to have some libation and possibly lunch. But instead, I'm here in Scottsdale. Whoops, what happened to David? We've lost him. Patrick disappeared, but David has disappeared. So Jeffrey, we will talk together until David reappears. Our theme today was international crime because I've had so much fun over the years talking to you about your wonderful series set in Greece with Andreas Kaldas, whose personal life and professional life has progressed over the course of, let me think, it's 9 books and we have a 10th coming up, right?
We have an 11th.
11th coming up. Okay. And the 11th one coming up is set on Naxos and is out, the 6th of April. But it's gone through so many title permutations, I cannot now recall what is the final title?
A Deadly Twist.
A Deadly Twist. Well, it has one, that's for sure, because I remember editing it and being, as ever, impressed with your clever plot. In fact, we've had a lot of fun together over the course of this series, haven't we? Working out plot twists. Often I have to cut things out of your manuscripts because you say more than maybe is relevant. And then sometimes we have to go the other direction and we've tussled over villains, haven't we?
Oh, some of the villains have been really something to tussle over too. I would say that. Oh, I sort of pattern after the way you make me feel, you know, sometimes.
What, good or bad? I'm not sure I should pursue that.
I'm not sure I'm going to answer that.
That's all right. You can tell, those of you watching, Jeffrey and I have managed to stay friends across all these years together. We're here to talk about Murder in Mykonos, which was a number one bestseller in Greece and was brought to us by Jeffrey, which I love. But I would also like to mention that his second book, Assassins of Athens, I think has one of the truly great 30-page openers. I mean, it's really brilliant the way that it goes. So if you're interested in Murder in Mykonos, I would urge you to leap upon the sequel, Assassins in Athens, and prepare to be really surprised at how it goes. And it's interesting, Jeffrey, isn't it? How, you know, you've written now 11 books about this character. But they never go the same, do they? Each one is like writing all over again.
I attribute that to the fact that I have such a lousy memory. I forgot what I wrote before, so I can't repeat it.
No, I don't think so. I think every story has different demands. So one of the really wonderful things about your series is that you take us to a different part of Greece. I mean, these are ideal books for people who are either missing Greece, and I wish they were there, who've never been to Greece, and would like to go. I mean, they're fabulous travel books. And in each one of them, Jeffrey subconsciously, we've had a lot of conversations about this and his sort of Cassandra role, manages to link what's going on in present Greece to historical tropes in Greece. So in Murder in Mykonos, what are we talking about, Jeffrey? There's a couple things in play.
Well, Murder in Mykonos basically reflects how an island reacts to a threat to its financial security. Islanders can be very competitive. In fact, they can be less than helpful internally. But when there's an external threat, they all unite and want to see how they can protect it. My books, actually, to be realistic about, they create a mosaic of what Greek life is about. Each one focuses on another element of the Greek society. Like that was like how the community reacts. Assassins of Athens is Greeks in their government. Pray on Patmos is Greeks in the church, and when it was Greeks and immigrants, Greeks in the family, Greeks in the military. Each book has a different theme to it. I didn't realize it until someone pointed out to me. It's like a mosaic of the Greek culture. But that's really what I think it's how it's become. I always look for a theme that will work. And the first one, Murder in Mykonos, was because that's how I started writing. I gave up my career as a lawyer because I wanted to describe what I saw as a society, the politics, the people of Mykonos. And when I wrote it, I thought I was going to be hung by a tree in the harbor because I spoke about Mykonos that way, but they loved it. And they've loved me, and it's been a wonderful relationship I've had with the Mykonians and the other islanders.
Indeed you have. And Mykonos has really changed quite a lot over the course of the however many years that you have spent full summers there. And a lot of that is, you know, the cruise industry and the heavy tourist industry. I've been there only once, and even I could not help but notice that the absolute crush of people when you have two or three big cruise ships and they all debark passengers, and you've got a small island that suddenly gets, you know, thousands of extra people in the course of a day.
Boy, if you put your finger on it, I've written basically a trilogy about Mykonos. Murder in Mykonos, I wrote, that was the first book. The fifth book was The Mykonos Mob, which talked about, the first book was about how Mykonos used to be.
Right.
The Mykonos Mob was how it was changing based upon a financial crisis. And I gave some warnings. My most recent book, it's out, The Mykonos Mob in paperback, it's Island of Secrets. That book is about where Mykonos has evolved, where it is now. But what got me, I couldn't believe it, when you just said to me about how tourism has affected the island, that's the whole point of the new book coming out, A Deadly Twist. It's about the battle between those who want to maintain traditions and those who are looking to exploit tourism.
Well, that's absolutely true. And Naxos is, a relatively close neighbor of Mykonos. In fact, not far away, right?
Oh, and it's very close by. It's one of the largest islands in Greece. It's a green island. David's back. Thank you.
Right, David. We can see you, but we can't quite hear you yet. But I'm sure you will. There you are. Wonderful.
Well, let me say something here. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
We can see you and hear you, and we're delighted to see you. Let me just finish up a thought here with Jeffrey, and we'll swing back to you. So, Jeffrey, you're right. You had Murder in Mykonos, and then I'm trying to remember, the Mykonos at Midnight is one title, and then...
Oh, it's Murder in Mykonos, Mykonos after Midnight, at Mykonos after Midnight, and then the Mykonos Mob. The paperback version was changed. It's called Island of Secrets.
Right.
But Mykonos Mob, Island of Secrets are the same book.
No, I understand that. And so one of the things that's happened with Mykonos is not only has the tourist industry arrived and absolutely slammed it and changed the islanders' life, but it has brought big money and big corruption to Mykonos, which is what you write about in the second and the third iterations of your trilogy. But in the first one, the ancient theme, which I really liked, was kind of like, you know, religious frenzy. You have, you know, if you think back to the ancient Greeks and what are the things we look for in the plays and in the other cultural things that we've acquired. And one thing we do know is that, like the Bacchanal and so forth, that there were religious frenzy and people behaving very strangely in the grip of all it, not totally dissimilar to events of, let's say, January 6th, which was, you know, in many ways kind of a cult thing that happened here. So it isn't like the ancient Greeks have a monopoly on it, but.
One of the biggest compliments I ever was paid was by our dearly beloved Barbara Levy. she wrote a piece, 35,000 words about Murder in Mykonos, almost as long as the book, comparing it to Ibsen. I didn't quite write it that way, but she talked about the underlying tropes and that was, God bless. That was, I read that through and said, wow, did I really mean to do those things? She said I did, but who knows?
Indeed. Who knows? Well, let's go back and talk to David now that he's back with us. And I see, David, that you have covers up on the wall behind you of your wonderful books. Called Tuscan Stone is the very first one. Give us your background, because there's a reason. Jeffrey writes about Mykonos because he spent a lot of summers in Mykonos and blended in and thought that he would tell its story. Why did you decide to write a series set in Italy?
Well, as you know, I'm a retired Foreign Service officer, and among my postings overseas were three different ones in Italy for a total of about 9 years. So when I retired, I started a business writing tourist information for people going to Italy, because once you get the Italy bug, I mean, 9 years, it kind of sticks with you. And I did that for many years, and then because I was writing about small towns, especially in northern Italy, Tuscany, Umbria, those places. And I got to the point where I said, you know, I should probably write a book, and why don't I try to write some stories that go along with these fascinating small towns? So that's how it got started. And it took a while, as you know, but finally, there it is. Cold Tuscan Stone came out.
So like Jeffrey's books, your books are absolutely wonderful for the travelers, for somebody who wishes they were in Italy or wishes to go to Italy whenever we can all safely travel again. And David does a wonderful job in talking about food and wine, because actually after he'd published two or three of them, we woke up and realized that it would be more fun if he included, at the end, if he included a discussion about the fabulous food and the wonderful wines and so forth they were drinking. In fact, one of the books is about the cheese industry or particular kind of cheese set in Italy. So that one, Murder by Cheese, actually, it was really fun. But also, very interested in art and architecture. And in the new book that he's got coming out, which is not the one we're talking about today, there's some museumology involved. There's botanical garden. Do I remember that right? That the body is found?
You do. You do.
I know I edited it, but it was like, what, 2 years ago or something? It feels like it. And so Italy's cultural heritage really plays in to David's books, and you can learn a lot about painters and all kinds of wonderful stuff and food. So Cold Tuscan Stone, David, we're in Volterra, right? We are going back to this hilltop town, and there's archaeology involved. In fact, it opens, doesn't it, with a scene in which archaeology is playing.
Yeah, exactly. It involves stolen Etruscan burial urns, which are these great big things, usually made out of alabaster or something else. And someone is stealing them, or at least that's what the authorities think. And the first scene, which is one of my favorite scenes, actually, of first scenes that I've written, is some guy trying to sell on the black market one of these burial urns. And it turns out he's trying to sell it to somebody who works for the art police. So it doesn't quite work out. But there's a lot of archaeology in the thing. A lot of it takes place in this museum, which exists along with Volterra, really exists, called the Museo Guarnacci, which is probably one of the best Etruscan museums in Italy, which means in the world, right? So a lot of the action takes place there, including some of the climactic scenes. But yeah, you get a lot of history and archaeology and especially food in my books.
And wine. Don't leave out the wine, David. The wine is really critical.
Right. It's hard not to, when you write about Italy, not to write about the culture and the food, because of course the food is culture. And you know, I get a lot of feedback from from readers. What authors would like, I'm sure Jeff's the same way, is where a reader writes to you and says, God, I love the way you developed your characters and the plot. Plotting was really good and it kept me. A lot of mine write and say, David, I really like the food. I really want to go there and eat that food that Rick Montoya is eating. But that's fine. They also like the mysteries.
So let's talk about Rick a little bit. Rick is American. He's actually from New Mexico, but his mother's family is Italian. And happily, for purposes of crime fiction, his uncle is an Italian police officer. He's a high-ranking cop in Rome. But Rick himself is a translator. He's not a professional law enforcement guy, but he seems to get propelled into cases because of his translating skills. But his uncle also has a role to play. So did you, from the beginning, work out that a private investigator, because Jeffrey's got a cop, so he doesn't have this issue at all. He's already got Andreas in the police force. If you were going to have an amateur sleuth, so to speak, a translator, or call him a professional, but he's still not a professional sleuth, that you were going to need an Italian cop to make this thing work. Have I lost you? Are you there, Jeffrey?
I'm here.
You're there. I think we've...
You want me to answer the question for David?
Sure.
Yes, we want an Italian cop. When I'm not in Mykonos, I love being in Italy. That's my second favorite place. In fact, we were the last place we were before this all hit was Toscana, as a matter of fact. I have a friend, it was a lovely place there. And I understand why David loves Italy so much. Mm-hmm. And his books are great, by the way, even beyond the food. But I'm sure when we write a book, the problem is you're getting at is if you're not a cop, you can't get access to information that you would probably need. So you have to have somebody, some connection. In fact, I can't think of any television show or anything at all where there is no cop, as the protagonist, that there isn't some connection. It may be someone you're battling with, but there's always a cop involved. That's how you need to get information.
Well, but
I'm sure you'll tell me 12.
Right, but it's not just getting information, Jeffrey. Nobody has the power to arrest. You know, if it's crime fiction, in the end, you assume.
Well, yes, I agree. No, yeah. I agree. You need the arrest as well.
Right. So you need somebody who can come in and you know, cart this person off to jail or whatever it is that's going to happen when you get to a resolution of it. And there's a difference between a police procedural, such as you write, and Michael Connelly writes, and, you know, Ian Rankin writes, and, you know, great cops are. Val McDermott wrote a beautiful police procedural last September that I loved, that went from Police Scotland, and then she had to go and cooperate with the English authorities, and then it went over to Ireland, and she had to work with the Irish police, you know, and it was like a whole tour of the United Kingdom and Ireland British policing. And that's a lot different than writing a private investigator or an amateur sleuth.
I know firsthand, this may be a surprise to you, but it was a surprise to me. I just finished the standalone that would probably be a series of it. And it involves someone who's not a cop, not a policeman. And so it required different aspects, different ways to make it happen. You're absolutely right. It's different. It was a nice way to clean the pipes out, so to speak, coming at it from a different perspective.
But one of the good things about having a not cop is that you can have somebody with really great professional expertise that the police can use. For example, Aaron Elkins wrote a fabulous series, which I absolutely loved, about Gideon Oliver, who is a forensic anthropologist. So he would be useful in cases where, you know,
sure,
bodies needed or various.
There was that guy in that, was that code, the something code?
Oh yeah, right, him.
The
enigmologist. No, that's Lincolntown, yeah. Right? It's a series about an enigmologist, which is one of my very, very favorites. But yeah, so
I had something in my throat. I went to one of those guys recently.
Oh yeah?
An enigmologist.
Yeah. So anyway, one of the other things that I really liked about Murder in Mykonos, while we're hoping that David will rejoin us, is that the little island of Delos is is what, like 10 miles offshore or something from?
No, it's a mile. No, it's a mile away. It's maybe 10 minutes.
Only a mile, right.
Very close. Oh yeah, it's very close.
And Delos was a very sacred island. And so, you know, you're able to bring, as I mentioned earlier, there's a religious frenzy theme in Murder in Mykonos, but how handy that Delos is right there because it ties right into that.
Delos was the center of much of the world there, the Delian League with Athens and all that.
Right.
Delos, I got the numbers aren't quite fixed in my head, but I think it was 70 years before. It was a huge slave market, 30,000 people lived there, maybe even more. It was an unbelievable place. And about 70 years before Common Era, they backed the wrong ruler and they were sacked and the place was leveled. And it disappeared from the face of the earth until the late 1800s when the French archaeological school decided to come in and start looking. And now it's become, it's an international attraction. People come there. My book, of course, involves that first book did. David is back.
David is
back. I try to cover it for you.
Hi, David. So let me.
You're a good man, Jeff.
Let me pick back up where I was going to go seamlessly as we move along here. Tell us, first of all, where is Volterra? Because many people may not have any idea where in Italy you can find the city.
Volterra is in Tuscany. Florence is, of course, the capital of Tuscany, and Volterra is a little bit south and a little bit west of Florence, kind of near the coast. It's a little bit off the beaten track as far as getting to it, which makes it even better because there are less tourists.
So is it a walled city, a kind of hill city?
Yes, very definitely. It's an old Etruscan city. It's one of the main cities in the old Etruscan Federation, one of the main ones. And it's definitely the walls around it, the bottom part, it's great. Typical Italy stuff. Probably it's the same way in Greece. You got the really old Etruscan stones on the bottom. And then as you work up in the walls, it becomes Roman and then sometimes medieval later. But yeah. Definitely an Etruscan city. But as I tell people, it's got everything. It's got all the Etruscan history. It's got Roman ruins where, as you know, some.
Oh dear, don't freeze again.
Yeah. He's right. David is a real student of history. And he's right that in Greece, it's the same thing. There are churches that were built upon churches. Temples to Athena became temples to the Virgin Mary. You know, things like that. So you can go back and find history just through the wall, through the foundations of many, many places. They say there's not a bit of land in the Peloponnesus where blood is not spilled. I mean, all the wars with the Spartans and that, Peloponnesian Wars and what that may be. But when David talks about Italy, I mean, his books take you there. You feel as if you're in those parts. They're really a great read.
I think so too. And for those who are not familiar with the Etruscans were a major Italian civilization before, really pre-Roman. Michael Gilbert, years ago, the great British author, wrote, I can't remember the title because I'm having a senior moment, but he wrote a really wonderful book set in Etruscan Italy and had some of the same themes that David explores. You can't really get away from the antiquarian theme. And in an interesting way, since I'm here in the Southwest restaurant, it's not any different than some of Tony Hillerman's stories, you know, like The Thief of Time, because you have people who are pillaging these Anasazi rooms looking for pots or other cultural artifacts and artistic artifacts and all that can be sold on the black market to people who collect. And David's talking about the same thing in Cold Tuscan Stone, in these Etruscan burial jars, that they can be faked or they can be real and they can be illegally sold. Italy has some very strong laws, right, Jeffrey, about exporting national treasures. I mean, they had an unsuccessful attempt to retrieve that chariot from the Metropolitan Museum you know, they wanted it back, and the Met's answer was to build part of a new wing and put the chariot right in the middle of it. So it's a little bit like the Elgin Marbles, you know, the British are not giving back the Elgin Marbles to the Met.
In Greece, they call them the Parthenon Marbles. I don't really like Lord Elgin, but
well,
no, you're right. And Delos, for example, after the place was leveled, it became like a building supply area. People went over there and just took it to build other places. Other temples were on different islands like Tinos. Places were built using materials from Delos. And if you go to, this is one of the strangest things. If you go to Mykonos, you walk down the street and see this ornate cornice or this window in marble. Those are all items taken from Delos and used in building places in Mykonos. So you'll see this elaborate carving and say, what is that doing here? It came from Delos.
Well, I've traveled. Sorry, go ahead.
Sadly, when the French came in, they knew what they wanted to do. So they disregarded the things that didn't fit to what they wanted to do, and they just threw it all into the sea. So now trying to come back and build up places which were not cataloged properly, it's really been a real chore for the subsequent archaeologists to do. I remember going to Rhenias and the Jason Island. There was the church said, leader said, you cannot be born or die on Delos. All bodies had to be taken from Delos that had been there and transported to Rhenia. So you went over to Rhenia. I went to an event upon a Yeri there one day, and I'm walking by. This is a Doric column, top of it, with a fence post stuck in it. I said, what's that? He said, he needed a fence post holder. So he went and took a piece from Delos and brought it over here. I mean, I couldn't believe that would be in the Met. But there it was. The farmers had to do what they had to do. That was a practical way to live over there.
Yeah, but you know what? That's been true. I mean, when Henry VIII, you know, raised the monasteries, there are all kinds of English country houses built from, you know, excavating stone or actually just taking over some monastic buildings. And I've spent a lot of time traveling in Peru. And if you go to Cusco, you can see that when the Spanish came in, they went up to the Incan fortress, Sacsayhuaman, which is at a higher elevation than Cusco, quite a lot higher. And they tore down a lot of what the Inca had built and rolled the stones down the hill so they could build the cathedral and the plaza and so forth in Cusco. So, I mean, I think it's a universal that people pillage earlier building sites and use those materials. It's really interesting to look at what's going on with Notre Dame, because in order to rebuild it, a lot of the stone came from these old quarries way under Paris. And they've been trying to figure out, looking at the little fossils and stuff inside the stonework in Notre Dame, where it came from and if they can find it. Because in order to make the cathedral work, you had to have much heavier stone at the bottom. And as you went up, they had to use this very much lighter limestone up at the top, because the weight otherwise, you know, would destroy the cathedral. I mean, it's amazing stuff.
That's interesting.
A documentary, but you know, we think we're so advanced and so smart, and it's fascinating to go back and look at craftsmen who, without any benefit of modern technology, worked out that they had to have, you know, stones of different, you know, different densities and different weights in order to build a cathedral that wouldn't collapse under its own weight.
That's it. I mean, these days we all think about how the lessons of the past have not been heeded, and I'll have to discuss what that major one is. But it's everybody decides to reinvent the wheel. They just want to reinvent the wheel. He's back.
He's back again.
I went out for a beer. I had a quick beer, came back.
Now you just went to the bar here at Pasquale's in Santa Fe and ordered a margarita, I can tell. So while you were gone, we talked about the Etruscans briefly, and I mentioned that Michael Gilbert, the great British crime writer, had written a book which might have been called The Etruscan Tomb or something very close to it, in which he touched on some of the themes that you have got in Cold Tuscan Stone, and that it's almost impossible to really avoid the antiquarian, you know, the forging of antiques or the illegal sale of antiques in a place like Volterra. There's a lot less of the Etruscan civilization than the Roman civilization, if I recall, right? Much less of it left.
Yeah, I mean, they weren't as widespread as the Romans. And the Romans, of course, took over the Etruscans, or you can say the Etruscans took over the Romans and became this a lot. The Etruscans are always talked about as being mysterious, those mysterious Etruscans,
right?
Because their language for a long time couldn't be deciphered. They didn't figure it out, but only in the last like 100 years or so had they figured out the language.
Yep, it's sort of like the whole Rosetta Stone thing, right?
Yeah, it was really, really strange. But a lot of the Etruscan stuff were melded, you know, religion and other customs and things were melded into the Roman culture.
Well, don't you think the Romans were among other things, famous borrowers? I mean, they were perfectly willing to go and conquer, and then they would incorporate stuff into Roman society. So that's probably why they prevailed over so many different countries and civilizations, is because they were good at borrowing.
Yeah, borrowing, including religions. They adapted a lot of the religions of the countries where they conquered, and they were very open-minded. Anybody could practice whatever religion they wanted. So it was only when they ran into the Christians where the Christians said, no, it's the only one. So that's where they had a problem there. But in general, they were very, as you say, accommodating and very practical in their conquering.
So before we lose you again, hoping that we do not, let's jump from Cold Tuscan Stone, which is a reissue of your first book with that beautiful new cover that Patrick showed us. Let's talk about your book coming out when, and what is the title of the new book?
The new book is called To Die in Tuscany, and it comes out April 13th. And despite the title, most of the action doesn't take place in Tuscany. The title is tied in with something that the victim says at some point in his life. But most of it takes place in Urbino, which I hope you've been to, Barbara. It's a great town.
Not yet. There's a lot of Italy that I really would like to see. And it's true of Jeffrey, too. I've been to the islands and around, you know, Athens and all, but I have not actually been in the interior of Greece. And I've always wanted to go to Delphi and, you know, some of the great, great sites in Greece. So I'm hoping, not actually, to be fair, I also want to go to Sicily, which is an interesting island in that it combines both the Greek and the Roman, because the Greeks were there. And then, I mean, I've been to Sicily 3 or 4 times, but I've never driven around it. And that's a different travel experience to drive around the country, you know, than to cruise along the outer edges.
Yeah, we spent when I was working, they sent me down to Palermo to cover the operation there for a couple of weeks. So I got to know Sicily pretty well. Some of the best Greek ruins in the world are in Sicily. I mean, they're great stuff.
No, they really are. It's amazing stuff. And, you know, there's the whole story of, gosh, now I'm going blank again. Was it Aristotle who was the tutor in Sicily, who was it?
Plato, I think.
Was it to Alexander? I'm trying to remember. Who was it?
Alexander. Also right. Alexander.
Was it Plato? Okay.
Well, contemplating the bust of Homer.
Yeah, Sicily was a place where all that happened. So you guys could combine one day. You could write a book set in Sicily and bring together it'd be fun. Bring together the Greek and the...
It would be fun. It is fun. Being with David is always fun.
And
although
Sicily
he keeps
has,
fading out on us, but not now.
Right. Sicily has fabulous food too. Fabulous food and wine. So, you know, that would be kind of neat. I like that idea. Sicily
is... Well, David was off. I was just saying, you were off before. I say my second favorite place is Tuscany.
Yeah, anyway, the new book takes place in Urbino, which is actually in the Marche, Le Marche region, which is just a little bit east of Tuscany. And Urbino is the town of Federico da Montefeltro, one of the most famous, Renaissance princes. And he was a great warrior and a condottiere, as they say, you know, soldier of fortune. And he built this amazing castle, which looks like something out of Disney World or something. where some of the action takes place, because it's now a museum, a great museum. So, and of course, Urbino is also the hometown of Raffaello di Urbino. And his stuff gets involved in it to a certain extent too. So we've got the old thing, you know, the art, the culture, and of course, a lot of food.
We do. We even get to visit Raphael's birthplace, at least briefly, which is a lot of fun. So, well, I've wanted fans to come away from this, not only knowing that they can start at the beginning with your books. And Jeffrey, I think Thomas Perry wrote an introduction. He's been a fan of yours since the night I put the two of you together at the bar at the Hotel Valley Ho, and you stayed till breakfast, if I remember right. But
he's an amazing man. He's an amazing writer, an amazing human being.
Yes, he's really a wonderful guy.
We're good friends.
I'm really pleased to see that Eddie's List is his most recent one has done so well. And in any case, but I wanted readers to come away from this realizing that there are several more books by each of you and a new book, both of you, coming out in April. So, you know, that's a forward trajectory for people missing, as I've said from the beginning, really missing travel. David, Jeffrey, you said he's working on something else. So final question, have you thought about writing something that is not a Rick Mantoia and not in Italy?
The short answer is no. There's still a lot of neat, nifty little small Italian towns that Rick hasn't been to. So maybe if I ever run out of those, which I don't think I will, I might consider sending him somewhere else.
Well, but I'm not encouraging you to do that. I can remember somebody asking Louise Penny at a convention, maybe one of the last conventions before we all shut down, if she was ever going to write anything different than Gamache. And she said no, you know, she was never going to run out of material for him or a love of writing. And so I wasn't trying to encourage you to do it, but it's just an interesting question. I think Jeffrey wants to test his writer's muscles, and so we'll see how that works.
Yeah, right. Just to be clear, I wrote that standalone already. I'm now two-thirds into the next Caldas. I'm not abandoning Caldas at all. This was just something to do during the COVID crisis. Something I've been meaning to write for many years, and I now had the time to do it, and so I did it. But yeah, I'm not walking away from Caldas.
Well, I certainly hope not, because there's an awful lot more to say about it. Can you give us a hint about which part of Greece we're going to be in?
Ikaria.
Oh, yeah? Well, I look forward to it. You know, one of my favorite things is editing your books and David's. And so I'm so happy that even though I am no longer your official editor, I love being able to read your manuscripts when they are first developing. It's so much fun.
I couldn't function without you. I have to say, I couldn't function without you. And I have to say, one of the great honors of my life was being able to dedicate A Deadly Twist to you and to Rob.
Thank you. It meant a lot to us. We were really delighted. And David, I hope I'll get to see your manuscript as well when you develop the next one. I really enjoyed
it. Yeah, it's pretty much done. The next one, which would be number 8, takes Rick to Assisi.
Now I've actually been to Assisi. I've been to Assisi in Perugia. So that'll be great. I will truly look forward to that. I want to thank you both for joining us. You know, this technology is wonderful. Occasionally it has issues of one sort or another, but what we've learned is you just soldier on, you know, right through. The readers are very forgiving. Rob will turn this into a podcast, so I will send you the link to that, which you can post for your fans. And we'll talk about April, because it'd be nice to come back together and have a conversation. Revis had a new book, and Patrick did an event with Revis and Joe Lansdale last week. So his new book is called Laying Bones. So, you know, it's nice to see you guys continuing. I loved editing. I never really loved publishing, because both of you know me well enough to know that I loathe corporate life. Just is not for me. So this is very nice to be able to. And I want to recommend to you an author that I discovered and was able to work with named Weisel. I call him Fred, but his name is Jonas Weisel, W-E-I-S-E-L. And he has a new book. He has his first book coming out in February called The Silenced Women. And I really like it. So ask your publisher to get you a copy and take a look at it. I think you'll enjoy it.
Hey, Barbara.
Thank you.
Patrick, there you are.
We don't really have many questions, but I do have a question. Can we repeat the title of their forthcoming books, sure. The April books?
Do you want to turn yourself back on?
If you insist.
Well, why not? That way we can see the bookstore is still alive and flourishing.
Yep,
right.
We're here.
Well,
yes.
You want the new, okay. The new book coming out for me is number 11. It's called A Deadly Twist.
And the book, the first book in your series is called Murder in Mykonos. And David, yours is called Cold Tuscan Stone.
Correct. Cold Tuscan Stone.
There and the book that's coming out in April is called?
To Die in Tuscany.
To Die in Tuscany. Right. I knew eventually Tuscany would work its way into one of your titles. It was bound to happen.
That Michael Gilbert book, by the way, I looked it up. It's called The Etruscan Net. N-E-T.
Okay. And it's a wonderful book, I might add. I don't know if it's even in print anymore, but it was the first time I really ran into, this is one of the great things about crime fiction. I didn't know much about the Etruscans until I read Michael Gilbert, and he had a lot to say, which made it interesting. Any other questions, Patrick, you wanted to address?
Let's see. Well, Donis Casey, your fellow Poison Pen Press author, wishes
hey, Donis.
She says she'd like a little teaser about Jeff's standalone.
It's sort of like a combination of George Smiley, the Enforcer, and, well, that's sort of enough right there.
Donis is not going to help you. Donis, in fact, her new book, Valentino Will Die, we are going to have a conversation with her on Saturday the 30th at 4:00. And it's the second adventure of Bianca Dangereuse, which I think is a really brilliant idea for a mystery series set in 1920s Hollywood. It's a lot of fun. Anything else?
That's about it. I do have a customer who made a nice comment. She just said, I think her name is Lida, or Lida, L-I-D-A. Not Lida in the Swan, L-I-D-A. Thanks for doing these Zooms. Love your books, Mr. Seiger. I feel as if I'm traveling virtually, which is especially important in these times, which is a nice sentiment.
Indeed it is. Oh
God, thank you.
Larry concurs.
Thank you very much.
It's been a real pleasure.
I'll go to Tuscany.
Well, I still think the two of you need to write a book together in Sicily. I'm going to work on that project. I like that idea. Anyway, it's really been wonderful to spend some time with both of you. Thank you so much for joining us. And we'll look forward to April and we'll have another round. So thanks, Patrick, for hosting it. All right. See you soon. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.